David is one of my very favorite people. Last night I said there were very few people that could just be introduced with one name. If it's an event like this, it's only David Hartman. But what you don't see is the work that goes into it. Really good people make it look easy. Here he is, David Hartman.
Oh, sit down. Stop, stop. Sit down. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all very much. Good evening. Wow. I wish you could see what I'm seeing out here. This is awesome. Thank you. How many of you are old enough to have remembered watching the saga of Apollo 13 play out live? Oh, wow. Oh, wow. Fabulous. Okay, for those of you who are not old enough, a little bit of quick background to put what you're going to hear in perspective. We're now used to having thousands of satellites zooming around the planet. They, of course, have metamorphosed how we live in our world. Until 1957, there was no such thing as an artificial satellite. Well, that's when the Soviet Union launched the first one. It only weighed 184 pounds, and they called it Sputnik, and it zoomed around the world, and all it did was beep. It beeped, and it beeped, and it beeped, and those beeps told the world we, the Soviet Union, are first in space before the United States. Well, then in April of 1971, 4 years later, they launched Yuri Gagarin, a cosmonaut, and put him into orbit, and Alan Shepard, our first astronaut, still had not gone into space. He did a month later, after Gagarin. But then President Kennedy, just a few months after he was inaugurated, went before Congress and launched a man, a crew, and have him return to Earth safely in this decade. Well, they're only about 8.5, 9 years later. It was one of the greatest challenges to our country of all time. It also may be the last time that our whole country got behind one goal, and that was to reach the moon before the Soviets. So there were three programs. There was Project Mercury, 6 one-man flights. There were then 10 two-man flights called Project Gemini, then 11 three-man flights, that was Apollo, and each and every one of these flights had new challenges, new unknowns, and each flight built on what had been learned with the flight before. So there was no sure thing with any one of these flights over those 8 years. Well, in just 8 years since Kennedy gave the speech, Neil Armstrong, of course, became the first man to land on the moon, and 12 Americans then walked and worked on the moon in subsequent years. This was indeed the most remarkable scientific and technical achievement in history, and it was accomplished by hundreds of thousands of dedicated Americans. They were patriots, they were brilliant engineers, and managers, and academics, and technicians, and of course, the aviator, test pilot, astronauts. Four of these men are with us tonight. These guys are literally walking, talking encyclopedias about the entire history of our more than 50 years in space. They were there from the very beginning of Mercury, on the inside, the hands-on team from the very beginning of Mercury, all the way to the International Space Station. So please welcome these four gentlemen right now. The first one is Bill Reeves. His first job at NASA, just out of college, was overseeing and developing the electrical systems of the lunar module as it was being designed and built. He was a flight controller, he was a flight director and or mission manager on many missions, including Apollo 13 and 16 shuttle missions. He was a member of the first consultant group to visit Russia regarding the shuttle Mir rendezvous, STS-63 of the shuttle, in February of 1995. Please welcome Bill Reeves. Thanks, sir. Milton Windler, NASA engineer, flight controller, and flight director. He was deeply involved at the highest levels with the missions from Mercury, Gemini, Apollo, Skylab, Space Shuttle, Skylab, the International Space Station, and he was one of the four primary flight directors on Apollo 13. Milton Windler.
Am I supposed to shake your hand?
Huh? Fred Hayes, Marine, a fighter pilot, test pilot, lunar module pilot on Apollo 13. He was one of only 24 men to fly to the moon. He would have been the sixth American to walk on the moon if the mission had not had the catastrophic explosion. He was slated to command Apollo 19, but that mission was canceled, and Apollo 17 was the last one. He commanded three Space Shuttle Enterprise free flight landing tests at Edwards with Gordon Fullerton, by the way, in the right seat. He has 9,300 hours of flying time, 6,200 in jets. Fred Hayes.
He said we had that.
Jim Lovell, Naval Academy graduate, naval aviator, night fighter pilot, test pilot for 4 years on the F-4 Phantom. Then, of course, he became an astronaut. He flew more missions than any other astronaut in that period, four of them, Gemini 7, Gemini 12, Apollo 8, and Apollo 13. He was the first of three astronauts to fly to the moon twice, and the only one of those three who did not actually get to land on the moon. He logged over 715 hours in space, and because of their trajectory in Apollo 13, he, Fred Hayes, and Jack Swigert hold the record for flying the farthest distance that humans have ever traveled from the Earth. Navy Captain retired, Jim Lovell. Okay, so where do we start? It's a saga, as you all know, but the wonderful thing about tonight is that these guys were all, you know, key players in the whole thing. Obviously, Fred and Jim in the module, and the two flight directors over here, and they were on the ground while these guys were zooming around trying to figure out what to do, and so were those guys. Start us off, Milton, as a flight director, tell us, you know, most of us, probably all of us, except you four, have never been in mission control. And we see all those two or three or four tiers of consoles during a mission. Who is sitting at those consoles and what is going on those consoles?
Well, we have the mission divided up into different disciplines. And each console represents one of the disciplines. Maybe it's a flight dynamics, or maybe electrical systems, communications, that kind of thing. And so that's a team that comes together to make all the flight plan activities, or in the case of 13, any anomalies, addressing those anomalies. So, are you going to talk about the other people as well?
Yeah, but go back to the four primary flight directors. You were one of the four, right? There's a team
yes.
of four. So explain that. Who's got the authority? Who's in charge? And how do you pass off from each other, because you can't work 24/7 for days?
Well, that's right. Actually, we worked according to mission phases. We trained for each team. Each flight director had a team. I had the maroon team, and we had a group of people. It was a lot more than the people that you see in the control center. We would simulate and plan for the particular phase that we were assigned to. In my case, I had it first. I had to launch, and then we took turns doing lunar coast. We had other people that would do the lunar landing. I was going to do the lunar excursion. So it was divided up into what we call mission phases, so you could simulate that phase, and whenever it happened, and sometimes they were delayed for various reasons, we would come on duty and do that. We usually overlapped about an hour when you'd come in and you'd read the log and you'd look and see what the problems were, if any, which there were usually a few small ones, and try to figure out what was going on with those and get ready so that when your turn came and they handed over to you. And I guess it's kind of like aircraft controls, as it was when I was flying anyway. You told a guy, I've got it, and you shook the stick, and then you were the one that was responsible for it. So that's kind of the way we handed over, and whoever was in the flight director chair was responsible for making the mission activities come about.
Bill, the simulations, working up to a flight, how much attention went to simulations and preparing for each one of these flights, Bill?
Quite a bit. The flight controllers who supported all the missions, one of their primary jobs is just train. We had all kinds of textbook work that we did. We also worked in the control center. The flight control teams that Milt mentioned would go on shift in the control center, and the control center was coupled to the simulators, and you had a crew in the simulator, and the training people, who were, in my opinion, the unsung heroes of the entire program, would sit in the background, and they would throw failures in and see how the flight control team and the crew responded to those failures. And so that whole training process was what we did getting ready for missions.
In the lead up to the launch of 13, was there any one of those exercises, one of those sims, that wound up being prescient in some way about the emergency that emerged, into the flight?
We had one sim that I can remember where there was something similar, but it was nothing like what Apollo 13 was. And the problem with that is, whenever you have one of those catastrophes or one of those major failures, it depends when it happens. It's a totally different scenario depending on when it happens.
Okay. Jim, leading up to it, you'd already had three flights in Apollo 8 to begin with. How was the lead up for you, for Fred, for Jack Schweigert, who was only in there for a week? First, how concerned were you that Jack replacing Ken Mattingly, who was exposed to measles and all that, how concerned were you that Jack wouldn't be able to make the transition and be the crew guy that you were used to working with?
Well, Dave, the movie seems that Jack has to earn his wings every day. Actually, Jack was a very competent astronaut. In fact, he contributed into developing the malfunction procedures of the command module. So if Fred and I wanted a replacement for Ken Mattingly, Schweigert was the perfect person to have.
Right. So with the lead up and all the sims, what was your attitude about the launch, and how did the launch go?
Well, this was my fourth flight, so things were pretty knowledgeable about what was going to happen. Of course, this was Fred's first flight. Everything worked perfectly, and the countdown was fine. There wasn't any big delays in the final countdown. And so on liftoff, we were sort of happy.
So,
Except it took off at 13:13 Central Standard Time. And for some reason, I should have realized that something was going to happen.
Had there been any consideration about jumping from Apollo 12 to Apollo 14?
Well, actually, I had Apollo 14. And as I was training for Apollo 14, Fred and I, Al Shepard had Apollo 13. But he had been grounded for several years. And NASA management figured that he needed some more training. So they came to me and said, would you mind taking 13 and giving Al Shepard Apollo 14? I said, sure, why not? And my wife says, that's a bad number.